When I was trying to date guys, thinking that I was straight, I just had such sort of high standards for being able to like tolerate a guy almost, if that makes sense. I'm like, I just never really had that proper connective feeling. And I think as well, like a big sign was that I never really felt super nervous for a date with a guy.
Queers, queens, and in-betweens, hello and welcome to Same Sex, Same Shit. I'm Rochelle, and some weeks I'm joined by my incredible fiance Maddie, and other weeks I'm joined by powerhouse queer guests. Now, we love to chat all things lesbian, and each week we're going to be sharing that us queers do the same shit as everyone else, but better. Today I'm joined by Monica Chavoro, a performance-focused accredited sports dietitian. Mon works alongside numerous high-intensity athletes and is passionate about helping them optimize their nutrition for peak performance. She's made it her mission to share her expertise through social media, which is at Fueling Performance, where she promotes her inclusive practice. Mon, we will dive into questions surrounding nutrition and peak performance soon. To begin this episode, though, I would love to know, so you recently came out at 25, which was just last year. What did life look like for you before this? Do you ever recall like questioning your sexuality?
Thanks for having me, by the way. I think I never really gave myself the opportunity to properly question my sexuality before that. And I think that was due to a number of reasons. So probably one of them just having a lack of that sort of femme lesbian representation growing up and not necessarily relating to anyone that I came across that was queer around me, even though I did see myself as an ally. As well, I would probably say there were more like negative comments and connotations around like the word lesbian, or even just sort of homophobic comments that might have been offhanded, where it just didn't feel like it was a safe environment, just not a very nice environment to question my sexuality in. And then I think as well, just the whole compulsory heterosexuality really sort of blindsiding me there and making me conform to those societal expectations around you're expected to just end up with a guy. Mm-hmm. And I just always sort of had that idea in my head. So I think, yeah, for that reason, I never gave myself the opportunity to question it properly before that time and for all of those reasons.
Before that, were you surrounded by any other lesbians, or did you ever kind of even in your younger days have relationships or feelings towards girls, or it was kind of just like, that's not a thing in my world essentially? Like, I know it's a thing, but it's not a thing in my world.
Yeah, I think I definitely saw some lesbians in my life and I just thought that it was almost, when I was younger, almost like a choice. And I think in my own experience with whether it was friends or anything like that, like I never really had those feelings, or if I was really close with a friend, I might've just thought that, you know, I really like them as a friend and that it wasn't anything more than that.
Yeah. So questioning your sexuality at 25. So as I said in the intro, this was only last year. Mm. What is it like having some life experience and maturity kind of behind you? Like, I suppose I wouldn't say it's later in life, but it is, you know, mid-20s. You do definitely have a bit more experience and life maturity behind you. So what was that like for you, that process of questioning that?
It both made it harder and easier at the same time. The reason it may have made it harder was because I just thought, oh, I would have already known by now if I was gay. Like, surely I'm not, like, I would have known. Which I don't know if that was almost like gaslighting myself a little bit. But in terms of, yeah, having that more maturity, I definitely think it made it easier because I had more life experience. I'm a lot more self-confident than I was in my teens. I know what I want in my life and what I want in a partner. So I think having all of that experience and being older, it definitely made it easier to come to terms.
So what was coming out like for you? When did you start kind of questioning it? When did those feelings, and I guess that confidence, like you were saying, to come out to yourself first, what did that look like?
It was a roller coaster of emotions. Which, look, I'm sure it is for like every queer person questioning their sexuality for the first time. But basically I went through a period where I just had a few more signs that life was like throwing at me. I'm like, you know what? I really need to question my sexuality here. I want to go all in sort of leaning into that and just like really allowing myself to properly question it without sort of holding back, I guess. So I changed the Hinge preferences to women. I did go on a few dates with women because I'm like, well, if I don't try this and put myself out there, then how will I ever know? The more that I lent into that, the more I felt like me, the more I felt like I was finding a part of myself that I was missing in my life. And it just all made sense to me. And I felt really happy about it. And I was just really excited about it. So
it's so cool and it's really nice. And I know that a lot of people will probably resonate as well, because I certainly do. Like when I was in high school, I had a boyfriend and I always kind of thought to myself, I don't think I like him or this relationship as much as my friends seem to be enjoying and liking their relationships with their boyfriends. And then I couldn't work out if it was just him or just or boys in general. And as soon as I started dating girls, it was a very similar situation to you. So I completely understand what you were saying. Did you have that before you went and like took the leap and changed your Hinge profile? Did you have experiences with boys where you were kind of like, I'm not sure if this feels like I'm just not fully invested in it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think when I was trying to date guys thinking that I was straight, I just had such sort of high standards for being able to like tolerate a guy almost, if that makes sense. I'm like, I never really connected and I just thought, oh, you know, if I have similar interests and they're like decent looking, then okay, maybe he might be okay. Like I just never really had that proper connective feeling. And I think as well, like a big sign was that I never really felt super nervous for a date with a guy.
Yeah. Oh, that is a big sign. Yeah.
I think it was more like, okay, maybe you might be nervous to think like, oh no, does he like me back as a, you know, like my personality? Does he think I'm attractive, in terms of just like putting that back on me and like almost a self-confidence thing. But yeah, at the end of the day, I just don't think I ever really developed that proper deep connection that I, for example, now really feel for my current partner. So yeah, it's very different.
And then so you had to come to terms, I suppose, once you started dating girls and you were like, wow, this feels different, this feels like me. Did you find it easy enough to kind of accept yourself?
Definitely. Yeah. Felt it easy to come to terms with, and I was just really happy to find that part of myself.
So what did coming out look like for you then to the wider community?
So I did sort of reach out to some of my closer friends and told them that I started dating my now girlfriend Yaz, and they were really happy for me. So I had a very positive experience there. I think to the sort of like wider community, in terms of like my friends that I'm not as close with but I've known for a while, I didn't necessarily like reach out to them, but I did sort of post almost like a hard launch on Instagram on my personal account.
With it's the best way girlfriend. To do it these days.
Just like, I'm just gonna throw this out there and see what happens. But it wasn't really like a here is my girlfriend, it was just a post with her, so some people didn't really see straight away what it was. But I did have like positive sort of comments from my friends and messages, which was really nice. I did see in the insights there are a lot of sends of that post around, so I can only imagine what people were saying in the
good
DMs,
things, I'm sure,
hopefully. But other than that, my family did take it very well, like very supportive and accepting, which I did expect from them. So I wasn't like scared to tell, well, I probably was scared to tell them, but not from the fact that I wouldn't be accepted, just to sort of see how they're reacting. And it is always scary to it come is. out. But no, I think that was good. My nan was the cutest. She was so welcoming and accepting and so happy for me. And I think she was probably one of the ones that I was most scared to tell. And I think the reason is that people in her generation aren't always the most open to it or accepting of it. But yeah, she couldn't have been more accepting. So it was really nice.
That's so nice. And it is really nice to see when there is the older generation who do accept it and are a lot more open-minded, because it would be really hard for them to change their mindset. And I've seen it from both ends. You know, my grandparents on one side, not so kind of like accepting. They're different now, but you know, when we first came, or when I first came out and everything, you know, when Maddie came out and her grandparents, and she's got a couple of gay siblings as well, it's so different. So a lot of people, when I first came out, my grandparents weren't accepting, were like, it's just a generational thing. It's just a generational thing. And then when I see the other side of it, where there's that exact same generation who are accepting and can have an open mind and still love their grandkids and stuff, I'm like, okay, well, that proves that it's probably not a generational thing per se, because you can't just blame your generation on being like, well, I don't accept you because it's the times that I was from. But it's so nice to hear that you had a good experience coming out, because it can be so, like, such a roller coaster for you internally to, like, build up the courage to be like, okay, I've worked out who I am. I'm really happy. But yeah, now I've got to come out to the wider community. So let's talk about career and kind of how you got there and where we are now. So do you want to tell us what are your qualifications?
Yeah, so I'm an accredited practicing dietitian and sports dietitian. I have a Bachelor of Science majoring in Nutrition and Metabolism and a Master of Nutrition and Dietetics. I studied at the University of Sydney. And then after that, post-grad, I did a sports nutrition course to become that sports dietitian. So yeah,
and lots of study. Why a dietitian?
I think I was always interested in health and nutrition when I was younger, as well, sort of overcoming an eating disorder played a very pivotal role in me deciding to pursue that as a career. I was just super passionate about seeing nutrition in a more positive light in my life. So I think just always wanting to help other people in that area too made me decide to be a dietitian.
Why specifically a sports dietitian then now? What kind of merged you into that specialist role?
Yeah, I've always been very sporty. I've always loved keeping active. And I think if I had to choose, like when I was in year 12, for example, choosing what career I wanted to go into, I think it was choosing between like sort of exercise, sports science sort of side of things, as well as nutrition, and that sports dietetics sort of crosses and collides those two worlds very well. So yeah, I think that's why.
Amazing. All right, so we're going to delve into a little bit of, I guess, information from your clinical perspective. I'd love to get some knowledge and pick your brain about sports dietitian and everything like that. So I have to start with protein, because I would be doing Maddie a big disservice if I didn't. She is very interested and intrigued about all things protein. So how much protein should we be eating as a general rule? I suppose we can talk about, like, our demographic on this show is more so that like 20 to 40 year old woman. So I guess we could even start with that.
The Australian dietary guidelines recommend about 0.8 grams of protein per kilo of body weight per day. It's a bit of a mouthful.
Yeah.
So I guess, for example, a 60 kilo woman would be about 48 grams per day, which is quite low. So I generally really like to optimize things, and I think a lot of people could do with a lot more protein in their day. Generally, that recommendation is more just for sort of maintaining general health, but if we really want to optimize things, optimize health, for someone who wants to optimize their sort of body composition in terms of like your lean muscle mass, as well as if you're quite active, so doing like strength training or high intensity training, those sorts of things, I do recommend around 1.6 to 2.2 grams of protein per kilo.
So
body
a big
weight.
Jump.
A big jump. Yep. So it's almost double from the 0.8. Honestly, I think that's quite low. And even the general person who doesn't really exercise much, I would say even more towards that 1.2 would be what I would recommend more often. That higher end just really helps from a perspective of sort of staying fuller for longer throughout the day, optimizing your recovery from training and those sorts of things.
I want to know, does timing matter when eating protein? Because I have always heard, and for some reason had this in my head, that you shouldn't be eating really high protein meals at the end of the day because it can disrupt your sleep or...
Yeah, so I generally recommend actually distributing your protein intake across the day, just from those perspectives of sort of, you know, staying fuller for longer, appetite regulation, as well as sort of, yeah, recovery from training and that sort of thing. Outside of that, for sort of metabolizing and digesting food at night, particularly protein. Our body can really handle digesting food when we are resting. It does that quite well, which is where that sort of rest and digest saying comes from. But some people do find that they personally don't sleep well after eating too close to bed. So in that case, I would just personalize it and say maybe waiting 1 to 2 hours between eating dinner and going to bed.
So it's more so like that general rule of just not eating before you go to bed, not specifically not eating protein.
That's
before
right.
You go to bed.
Oh, yeah.
Interesting. Okay. And so I'm vego. Mads is mostly vego. We're actually probably almost plant-based to a degree. What are the best sources of plant-based protein, or maybe vegetarian protein, which is a little bit wider, that we can look at getting in? Because I think that's a big like point of contention, trying to get enough protein in when you're plant-based.
Definitely. So definitely your tofu, so soy-based products, tofu, tempeh, textured vegetable protein. Have you heard of that one?
I think I have. Is that the stuff that comes in a packet in the health food section?
That's
and
right.
And it kind of looks like dried mint.
Yes.
Maybe? Yes.
That's it.
I have. I've never used it. How would I go
good.
And use it?
So you basically just have to rehydrate it. So okay. I would recommend, they generally just say rehydrate it with water, but if you actually rehydrate it in stock, it gives it a bit more flavor because it pretty much absorbs all of the flavor that you add to it because it's a bit flavorless on its own, but it is a really good sort of like mock mincemeat.
And
it's high quality protein. So that's one I recommend. We've also got your beans, legumes, and that sort of thing. Soy protein isolate, which is more of that protein powder. That's a vegan option. As for more vegetarian ones, we could always go with like eggs and dairy, which are really good, high quality as well. But the other options for if you're vegan.
Yeah. In regards to specifically like your sports dietitian, and I know that you work with some high intensity athletes that you kind of like to optimize their performance. So the importance of fueling before and after exercise, what does that kind of look like in regards to like, I guess, I'm going to sound like a complete buffoon here, but like macro, micro nutrients before and what's important there versus like what's maybe more important after training?
Yeah, good question. So definitely your carbohydrates before training. And when we eat carbohydrates, we digest them and then they are stored in the muscles and liver as glycogen. So if we think about it, we've got that glycogen stored in our muscles and that's pretty much readily available to be used in exercise. It's broken down quite quickly in the muscles to give us that really good source of energy. So that will just really allow ourselves to optimize how high intensity we can go in a session and how long we can sustain that for.
Looking at eating it kind of directly before a workout, or like a 1 to 2, like a while before a workout, so it can kind of like store and then get converted?
Yeah, so it can be either 1 to 2 hours before, or it could be as close as like 20 to 30 minutes before. The only thing you would change there is the type of carbohydrates that you would have. So if it's further out, we would be looking at more of our complex carbs or sort of ones that have a little bit more starch and sugars in them. Whereas if we are closer to our session, then we would want to be having a higher sugar product because that's going to have less time to digest if we're closer to.
Okay.
So that means it's just more readily available and quickly digested.
And so what's an example of both of those, like the complex one that I would have? Not me, because I work out at like 6, so then I'd have to eat this complex carb at 4. Yep. But so what is something that you would eat a few hours before if you were, say, doing like a mid-morning workout versus if like you woke up and you were kind of heading straight to the gym quite early?
Yeah, so if you were having something a little bit earlier on, such as like 1 to 2 hours before, I would say something like a wholemeal sandwich or a wholemeal toast. It could also be like some rolled oats or something like that. Could even be some rice or pasta, depending on what time of day you're having that.
What your preference is.
Definitely not like 4 a.m., but like if it was an afternoon workout. If it was closer to, you could even do something like your dried fruit or just like some fresh fruit as well. For some people who do train really early in the morning, so maybe like a 5 a.m. session, it might even look like having, you know, half a glass of juice. So sort of more of those process options that will give us that quick sugar hit that won't necessarily make us feel too full or sort of like heavy before a session.
And is pre-workout is somewhere in that realm, or, you know, like would that substitute having that quick little like half a banana or half a glass of juice before a early kind of workout, or is it on a completely different scale?
Yeah, so pre-workout in terms of a supplement? Pre-workout?
Yeah, I like supplement and as well like if for that energy kind of hit.
Yeah, so it's definitely different. I would still recommend having those carbohydrates regardless, which we can go into a little bit more in terms of that fueling versus fasted. But I think having that pre-workout supplement in terms of with the caffeine and with your other performance enhancing supplements, that is something that could work for you. And if you find that that's what you would like to optimize your performance in that session, then it's very individual, but it is something that I personally enjoy using. But I'll also have that alongside the carbs, so different types of things to help in different ways.
Okay, and so let's then, since we're still on the before working out, let's talk about fasted versus fueled workouts. Is that how we would say it?
Yeah.
Fueled workouts?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, perfect. So yeah, what's, you know, what's the difference, what's the benefits, and is there like one that you kind of recommend in your practice over the other?
Definitely. So I often recommend fueling before your workouts, particularly if you have those performance-based goals. The only times I would say that I would be okay with a client not eating before their workout is if they're just sort of exercising for general health and enjoyment. They're doing more of a low intensity workout, and if they don't really have any performance-based goals, so they're sort of, yeah, just doing it, going through the motions, enjoying their exercise. Whereas if it is more of an athlete, even if it's just an everyday athlete that likes to, you know, work towards a goal of getting their first pull-up or getting a better time trial on the rowing machine, those sorts of things, I'd highly recommend having those carbohydrates pre-training, just because you will be able to push the intensity and really get the most out of your sessions. And then the more you do that, the more you're able to get the most out of your sessions day in, day out, is when you'll see that progress in the gym.
Amazing. Okay. I think I'm doing it all wrong. Like I, because I work out so early, I want to get my workout in, and it's the only time of day that I kind of really can optimize and have a consistent workout routine, because otherwise it might be at 9 a.m. or it might be at 4 o'clock, but then it kind of cuts into, anyway, that's just mum life. And I can't eat that early in the morning. So I do struggle with that. So then I guess I would be that type of person that would opt for that, you know, piece of fruit or juice or something like that, which is actually what I do. I generally just have like a glass of juice and I'm like, I don't know if this is beneficial or not, because I do want to be getting the best out of my workouts. But then when I'm struggling with like, I don't want to wake up too early to be able to like wake up and then feel like eating and then go to the gym. Anyway, that's a problem, of my own. So then we'll talk about post workouts. What is the, so we've got carbs, long and short acting carbs. I'm talking about it like it's a medication at work. Like I had a complex and
paramedic life.
Complex and non-complex carbs. And then post-workout, what are we looking to kind of eat after that? So to get the most benefits from what we've just done for the past hour or so in our workout.
Yeah, so protein is a big one post-workout. We've just sort of made little micro tears in our muscles from contracting them, especially if it is more of that sort of high intensity versus strength training. So getting in enough protein in a either post-workout meal or post-workout snack. Generally, we aim for around 0.4 to 0.6 grams of protein per kilo of body weight in that post-workout meal or snack, just to make the most of the benefits from that strength training and to optimally repair our muscles post-training. That will really signal to the body that we've got enough amino acids and protein available to reconstruct those muscles to become stronger than they were pre-workout.
Okay. And so what are some common nutrition mistakes that athletes or even just the general population make that you see? Is there any kind of out there where you're like, it's just due to maybe misinformation or lack of information?
I would say almost not eating enough in the front half of the day, because people might be scared to sort of overeat or eat too many calories. So they're sort of like backloading their day. But a lot of the time they'll get, you know, that mid-afternoon hunger where they want to eat half the kitchen when they get home before dinner. I think just making sure that you are eating, you know, a decent breakfast with some protein in there, eating a decent sized lunch so that you can have that better spread across the day and not necessarily just eat most of your energy towards the end of the day, because then we don't really make the most of the energy and nutrients that we could be getting at that front half as well. I think that's a common mistake that I would see with clients in practice for sure.
And so how do we stop that 3 p.m. crash? What is the kind of biology, or like what is the science behind why we have that 3 p.m. crash, or why we reach for, you know, high sugar quick foods at that time of day? Is there something that we could be changing or doing in the first half of the day to maybe try and avoid that?
Yeah, I think it's as simple as eating more in the front half so that we don't have that built up hunger across the day, because I think it's a bit of a delay almost. So, you know, we might be having a coffee early in the morning, which caffeine does have that appetite suppressant effect, so we might not feel hungry after our morning coffee, and then we go for a lunch, which might be, you know, a small salad and like a little muffin or something, whatever it is, and then by the time it hits that mid-afternoon, we're like, wow, I've barely eaten today. I actually am starting to get really hungry. So I think if we actually decide to have a proper nourishing breakfast that's balanced with our protein, carbs and fats, as well as some fruits and vegetables across the day, having a decent size lunch that's actually going to help meet your energy requirements in the day, then that will just in itself significantly help reduce that mid-afternoon snacking.
Okay. I think that's a very practical and helpful tip that I guess would slip a lot of, I suppose, people who listen to this podcast are parents or, you know, in that age range where they're kind of very busy working people. And that is a really good kind of easy thing to implement, to be like, okay, if I just fuel myself this morning, if that's the only thing that I do, then maybe I can avoid, you know, feeling really sluggish in the afternoon or having that crash or reaching for something crap at 3 o'clock. I love that. That's great. I'm going to take that on board. Thank you. So I want to talk quickly about supplements. Are there any supplements that are essential for kind of like optimal athletic performance in your eyes? I know that it is can be like personal based depending on the client or the person that's training, but is there anything that you kind of really like as a supplement wise as a sports dietitian?
Yeah, creatine is the one that definitely comes to mind. There is so much evidence behind it. It's one of the most well-researched sports supplements for performance. Just so many benefits to taking it. It is a very safe and effective supplement. So that is the main one that comes to mind.
What is creatine?
Yeah, so creatine, it actually is naturally found in our muscles and we can actually get it from eating meat. The reason why we supplement with it though is because we can't eat enough from food to reap the performance enhancing effects. So we actually need a very concentrated high dose. I believe if we need to get enough creatine for those performance enhancing effects just from food alone, you'd have to be eating about a kilo of steak a day, which is very impractical. And no one really, I'm sure there's some people that would do that, but to get those performance enhancing effects, we do need to supplement. And the way that it helps, it just really helps on a sort of biochemical level to recycle our energy turnover a lot more quickly. So that means that we can contract our muscles faster or for longer before we sort of burn out and need to rest.
So if someone who is vegetarian or plant-based like myself, do I need a different or higher amount of supplemented creatine in that sense, or can I get it from any plant-based foods?
Yeah, so I generally recommend for vegetarian or vegan athletes to definitely take creatine. For that reason, they will be lower in creatine naturally because they are missing those meat products. So if anyone would benefit more, it would be vegetarians and vegans from supplementing with creatine.
Okay, and what does the regime kind of look like? Is there a best time to take it, or is it like a pre-post-workout type of supplement?
Yeah, good question. So it is one of those ones that is more of a chronic build up over time rather than having an acute effect. So we don't necessarily need to take it pre or post workout, I do just recommend to my clients to take it the same time each day, because that's is what's going to help you sort of remember it to take it.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, we say about 5 grams daily is the way to go. Okay. You can do a loading phase, which is about sort of 20 to 25 grams per day for a week to reach those maximum creatine stores in our muscles, but you can still get there in about 4 weeks by just taking 5 grams daily anyway. Okay.
And so someone like myself, who's probably going to go out and get some creatine now because I'd never heard of it really before today. I do have specific kind of like training goals. Would a loading phase kind of be more beneficial for someone who hasn't really taken it and or is also vegetarian as well and is like starting to look into specific training goals?
Yeah, good question. I think you could always trial that higher dose to begin with for the loading phase to see if you can tolerate it. Some people do find that having that higher dose in the day doesn't sit well in their gut as okay. much. So I'd most often recommend just having the 5 grams daily, and you'll reach those peak stores in about 4 weeks anyway.
Okay.
So yeah, I would just say sort of get into the habit of taking it daily, because then if you... I guess it's easier to sort of build that habit rather than taking that loading phase to begin with and then going into the 5 grams thereafter. So honestly, either way could work. It just really depends on personal sort of preference and how you respond to it.
And while we're still on supplements, are there any supplements that someone following a vegetarian or plant-based diet should really be looking into and, you know, talking to someone or doing their own research about potentially taking?
Yeah, so I would say if you do really struggle to meet your protein requirements, having a protein powder as a very sort of convenience option to go to could be the way to go. Something like your soy protein isolate or a pea and rice blend would be a complete amino acid profile. So having a protein powder on hand is a convenience option to get your protein in. Another one would be, particularly for vegans, we know that vitamin B12 is... mostly from our animal-based products. So it is essential for vegans to supplement with B12. So that is one to always look out for. I think the next one would be iron. So particularly for if you're female, if you're athletic and you're a vegetarian, it's so hard to reach your requirements.
Terrible combination.
Absolutely. We need 18 milligrams per day for females alone. If you're very active, we probably need even more than that. And then if you're vegetarian, you'd probably even need more than that again, just because our vegetarian sources are our non-heme iron or less bioavailable. So it's almost impossible to get that much each day. So definitely checking on your blood levels, getting that blood test done, see where your levels are at. And then if you do need to supplement or get an infusion, either way, just really staying on top of that is super important.
Okay. Good to know. I would be doing the parents listening a disservice if I didn't kind of bring them into it. So we really tend to neglect our nutrition, I suppose, in those early stages of like having little kids, and we eat a lot of their leftovers, or we, you know, we don't kind of look after ourselves and what we're eating. We don't prepare meals because we feel like we're time poor. If you had one practical tip to give parents that they can like effectively implement into their day to like focus and like put the spotlight onto their nutrition, what would it be?
Practically, from a meals perspective, doing your batch cooking and freezing the leftovers, or even making use of the slow cooker are like really simple ways to make those nourishing meals, making sure that you've actually got enough sort of healthy meals in the house that are easy to grab and just reheat and eat, so that you actually have those options and are less likely to just sort of snack and graze for the whole day.
Yeah.
But outside of that, I just think sort of having those regular family meals and setting that example for the kids of, you know, what healthy eating might look like, and just eating as a family as often as possible to really show that.
And eating protein in the morning. Getting your big meal in the morning, if nothing else.
That's it.
That's definitely the one thing that I've absolutely taken away from this. So
awesome.
Mon, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your incredible personal story, but also gifting us with all of this knowledge about peak nutrition and performance. And I really, really appreciate it. And I know so many people will have gotten so much out of today. And if you want to, you should go and follow Mon at Fueling Performance on Instagram. She gives the most incredible tips, even more so than, you know, what was in here, and more practical day-to-day and food options, meal plans, performance tips. So definitely recommend going and doing that. But thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you all so much for listening today. If you'd like to connect with us and stay up to date with our day-to-day life as well as future episodes, you can do so on our socials at those.2mums. We absolutely love bringing you these conversations each week, so if you love it too, please subscribe and leave us a review. Chat to you all next week. Bye.